The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled Of Shmuel HaNogid and the Golden Age of Spanish Jewry, is dedicated to the merit and honor of Rabbi Arya Leib and Esther Peretzky on the occasion of their wedding. From the Arab conquest of Spain in the year 711 to the expulsion of the Jews in the year 1492, Spanish history has been inextricably linked to the Jews. It was through the help of North African Jews that the combined army of Arabs and Berbers first defeated the ruling Visigoths of Spain. It was through the aid of the indigenous Spanish Jews, who had been severely persecuted by the Catholic Church and the Visigoths for well over a century, that the Arab victory was cemented. Toledo, the Visigoth capital, was betrayed by some of its Jewish residents. Several of the towns which the Arabs conquered, including Cordova, were immediately left in charge of the Jews. In other words, the Arab conquerors felt that they would be totally loyal. By the year 718, virtually the entire Iberian Peninsula was in Arab hands, and a new era of freedom and prosperity began for the Jews in Spain. Now they could openly live life as Jews. And under the Visigoths, for much of the period, they were forced to live as Muranos. And as loyal allies of the Arab conquerors, they were offered positions of power which furthered enabled them to prosper. There's ample literature to attest to the high level of religious observance and Torah study among Spanish Jews during the post-conquest period. We quote here on page 1, first from the letter of Rav Amram Gon. And this was written in the mid-800s, in the 9th century. And we can quote from this. And he says, in all of Spain and all of the communities of Ashkenaz, this is France and Germany, may they be remembered favorably with blessing 1,000 times over. For they are full of Torah and mitzvahs like a pomegranate, which was a common expression. And their actions are beautiful, and they are stringent in checking for treifus. In other words, this is a question of when an animal is slaughtered, about its status as being kosher, and ritual immersion, and in all that is fit to be stringent. So speaking about Spanish Jews, as well as the Jews in France and Germany, he attests to the high level of religious observance. This is all in this period. We quote further here in paragraph B. This was written sometime later. This is by the Meiri, or Menachem Meiri, of 13th century province in southern France, speaking about the historical period under discussion and describing how there would be close connections between Spain and Iraq. Because in Iraq, this is the subject of the lectures of the last 2 years, Babylon, was really in that period the center of Torah scholarship. And students from Spain would regularly go to study in Iraq. And as we quote here, the disciples would come back home from the yeshivas of Babylon. In this way, the Torah spread out amongst all the lands of Spain from one end to the other. Those who would go for some period of time, come back, and then resettle in their communities and have an impact on the communities. These scholars would then guide their respective communities. Whenever they would have questions or arguments, they would send to the yeshivas. Tens of thousands of responses would come at that time on a constant basis. This is all in that period of time. However, history has not bequeathed us the names of Spain's outstanding scholars. Nor do we have in our possession any literature composed by the Spanish Jews of that period. It took well over 200 years after the Arab conquest for Spain to begin producing scholars and authors of world renown. The person responsible for this quantum leap from obscurity to renown was the renowned statesman and patron of Jewish scholarship, Rav Chisdoy ibn Shaprut, the personal physician to the Spanish caliphs, those the Spanish kings, Abd al-Rahman III and successor al-Hakim II. As we've covered in a previous lecture, it was due to Rav Chisdoy's influence that Spain became a leading center of Talmudic scholarship. Under the leadership of Rav Moshe, he was again one of the four captives. There were four Italian scholars that were captured by the Spanish Navy. They were sold into slavery. One of them, Rav Moshe, was sold into slavery in Cordova. And quickly, there was no one of his status there, and he rose immediately to become the leading rabbi and teacher in all of Spain. And it was really through the influence of Rav Chisdoy that this all happened. Later on, Rav Moshe's son, who was sold together with him in captivity, became his successor. This is Rav Chanoch. And because of Rav Chisdoy's patronage of scholars and scholarships, Rav Menachem ibn Saruk and Rav Dunash ibn Labrat, two of the world's most distinguished Hebrew linguists, made major contributions to our understanding of the Hebrew language and ultimately our understanding of the Torah. It was actually through Rav Chisdoy ibn Shaprut that the golden age of Spain that we refer to historically was ushered in. The scholars of this golden age, their stories, their contribution, is the subject of this entire lecture series. In this particular lecture, we'll be covering the scholars who lived at the beginning of this period, in the 10th and 11th centuries. While other periods of Spanish history are famous for their contributions to our understanding of the Talmud, this period, the 10th and 11th century, early 11th century, is most famous for its contribution to our understanding of the Hebrew language. At the beginning of the 10th century, like the year 900, a new era in Jewish scholarship was launched with the composition of Rav Sadia Gaon's Egron. This is the first Hebrew dictionary. Subsequently, Rav Sadia went on to compose an expanded edition of that same dictionary, plus a book on Hebrew grammar, as well as another work on words that appear infrequently in Scripture. That is a particular difficulty because it appears only once, and there's nothing to compare it to. So it has its own, which is a subject of scholarship amongst Jewish and non-Jewish scholars to this day. In addition, he translated the Torah as well as the other books of Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, into Arabic. Rav Sadia's efforts marked the beginning of an era of scholarly research, which ultimately led to the reconstruction of Lashon HaKodesh, the original Hebrew language, and to the rediscovery of the original rules of Hebrew grammar. Several historic trends converged at the same time to create an awakened interest in this field. First of all, dating from at least the Byzantine era, Hebrew liturgical poetry, piyutim, were a popular form of expression. We've described the early history of piyutim in a previous lecture, but in order to accurately compose a verse, it's vital to establish clear definitions of words and grammar. I mean, this is really the same problem when the Hebrew language became a living language. Again, this is that it had to go back to its roots. This is, what is the proper word? How is it expressed? Not necessarily as a reconstruction. There basically was creating a new language based on the old. But again, it was only because of the research that was done here. In fact, half of Rav Sadia's Egron, this dictionary, was devoted to proper suffixes. in order to facilitate rhyming. I mean, you have to know what the end of the word is in order to rhyme to the next, you know, to the next stanza. Poetry, however, was only one factor in the renewed interest in the Hebrew language. Another is that since the composition of the Quran in the 7th century, the Arabs expended great effort in studying, perfecting the rules of Arabic grammar. Basically illiterate before that period, the Arabs began producing an elaborate literature and concurrently perfected the linguistic tools to make that happen. This emphasis on proper language had an effect on the Jewish world as well. In the preface of one of Rav Sadia's books, he points out that since the Arabs were so well-versed in their laws of grammar, it certainly behooves the Jews, the people of the Torah, to be no less so. A third factor was the rise of the Karoyim, the heretical sect that developed at the end of the 8th century, that denied the validity of the oral tradition, as we went in great details in previous lecture about the Karoyim. They claim that a thorough and scientific reading of the text of the Bible supports their position, and that the traditional rabbinic understanding of the text was incorrect. The Karaites were extremely successful in attracting new followers to their movement. So much so that it was critical for the survival of traditional Judaism that the rabbis pen a rigorous response to their critiques. It was therefore crucial that the Hebrew language and its rules be thoroughly studied in order to counter the Karaite claims of how to read the Torah. By the way, Rav Sadia Gaon, which we've discussed previously, was the foremost opponent of the Karoyim. In fact, the Karaite movement began a precipitous decline in the wake of Rav Sadia's rigorous attacks against their movement and their scholarship. His life, as well as the Karaite movement, as we said, has been discussed in great detail in previous lectures. At approximately the same time of Rav Sadia, in what is now Tunisia, Rav Dunash ben Tamim and Rav Yehuda Kureish were writing seminal works on the Hebrew language and its relationship to other common Semitic tongues, Aramaic and Arabic. But their works, as well as Rav Sadia's, were written in Arabic, the common language of North Africa, Egypt, and much of Spain. But non-Arabic-speaking Jews, I guess most of us in the audience here, and those that lived in France, Germany, or Italy, had no access to this source of knowledge. The first grammarian whose influence spanned the entire Jewish world was Rav Nachman ibn Saruk. And this is, as you're going to see in the beginning of the bottom of the first page. Rav Menachem was born in the city of Tortosa in northeast Spain around the year 920. Ibn Saruk, by the way, is a family name and does not denote the name of his father. His father's actual name was Yaakov. In his youth, he traveled to Cordova, where he continued his studies, and under the patronage of Rav Yitzchok ibn Shaprut, this is the father of Rav Chisdoy, he was there throughout his lifetime. But when Rav Yitzchok died, Rav Menachem found himself without support, and he went back to his home in Tortosa. By the way, upon Rav Yitzchok's death, Rav Nachman composed a eulogy in song form that was copied and read in many cities throughout Spain. Evidently, this Rav Yitzchok ibn Shaprut, again, was a man of tremendous influence, and his loss was felt amongst the various Spanish communities. He's also reported, this Rav Nachman, to have composed a dirge that was engraved on the wall of the synagogue that Rav Yitzchok had built. Evidently, early on, he was a man of tremendous brilliance. He was evidently, it seems, that he wasn't in Tortosa for long before he was called back again by Rav Yitzchok's son, Rav Chisdoy ibn Shaprut. Rav Chisdoy made him his personal secretary in Cordova, gave him financial backing, which enabled him to continue his studies. You know, one is reminded about the idea of patronage. Basically, the artists in medieval and Renaissance Europe and post-Renaissance Europe were supported by wealthy patrons. Leonardo da Vinci didn't, you know, I mean, do like house painting on the side. You know, he didn't. There were people of means, or the church, or people of means who supported him. Mozart and Beethoven, you know, didn't give piano lessons, you know, in the afternoons. You know. So this was really common in the period, at least for people of true genius. As his personal secretary, it was Rav Menachem who composed the famous letter that Rav Chisdoy sent Rav Yosef, the king of the Khazars. You know, these were these whole nation of Jewish converts in what's today southern Russia. A subject, again, that we've discussed in the previous lecture. In this period, under the patronage of Rav Chisdoy, Rav Menachem composed the Machberes, the first Hebrew dictionary, which was written entirely in Hebrew. In other words, the Egron, which was a Hebrew dictionary, was really written in Arabic. I mean, it had the Hebrew words, but basically in between the lines was all Arabic. This was written entirely in Hebrew. Perhaps also, I'm not sure, but he was born in northeast Spain, Tortosa. That area was basically still within the under the control or the heavy influence of the Christians, or the Visigoths. So it's quite likely that he was not raised with Arabic, because it wasn't his mother tongue. Therefore, he was quite comfortable just in doing pure Hebrew rather than Arabic. As we previously pointed out, the works composed by Rav Sadia Gaon, Rav Yehuda ben Koresh, and Rav Dunash ben Tamim were written in Arabic, which was inaccessible to non-Arabic Jews in Christian countries. And because of its accessibility, the Machberes became popular throughout the world and is often quoted by Rashi, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra. In fact, Rashi quotes him well over 200 times in his commentary on Tanakh, on the Bible. Just on the bottom of page 1, we just bring one of those here. Which is very famous, Ur Kostim, in the bottom of the first page here, Ur Kostim, according to Menachem, which is not according to the Midrash, Ur means a plain or a valley, and that's where Avram came from. Again, Rashi, again, these are just a taste of, Rashi again quotes here on the top of page 2. Again, quotes from the Machberes of Menachem Yehuda ben Saruk here of the origin of the word Naphtoli. This is Naphtule. This is the where in the terms is the according to him means is similar to Psil, which is apostle Tzomed, closely covered. In other words, I wrestled, I groped, you know, or it says, I am now joined together with my sister in bonds, says, to merit children. Rashi brings others from the Targum that explain that to be a form of prayer. She prayed hard. She didn't, that she should have a, through her maidservant, she should have a child. Now that's the Naphtali, and has to do, Rashi says, with struggling. But Menachem understands it again to mean connection, like this close fitting, and to show really her sense of heightened dignity that now she has another child. Ibn Ezra, just to point out here, again quotes from Dunash, but he calls him Adoni ho Adonim. Look at this. So no avon Rebbe Adonim Halevi. This is beautiful. The poetry here. The word Dunash is Arabic, which means masters. And that's really so. He was given the name Arabic as Dunash, the Hebrew is Adonim, masters, and that really is the play on words here on this. This is on this quote. Where this Rav Dunash that we quote here is really was a gifted contemporary of Avraham Menachem ben Saruk. He, unlike, says Menachem, was not born in Spain. It seems he was born, says, in Fez, Morocco, from an illustrious rabbinic family. He went to Babylon at an early age and he became a disciple of Rav Sadia. He eventually moved to Cordova to continue his research and was supported, like Rav Nachum, by Rav Chisdoy ibn Shaprut. Rav Chisdoy ibn Shaprut, as we said, was the personal physician to the king, and through that generally the personal physician which had the closest contact had tremendous influence over the king and the royal court. Although Rav Dunash held Rav Sadia's master in the highest regard and defended him from the criticisms of Menachem ben Saruk, Rav Nachum ben Saruk, again, he was a later, in other words, he was the next generation after Rav Sadia. And of course, as a brilliant thinker, he had his own ways of looking at the Hebrew language. Rav Dunash, as a disciple, went to the defense of his teacher. But later on, he himself found room for criticism of Rav Sadia. The Ibn Ezra here, in this paragraph B, comes to Rav Sadia's defense. As we're going to see, this is really the whole history of scholarship as a whole. One critiques and the other defends, and there's a criticism on the criticism. And throughout the whole process, new ideas come out, and whole new vistas are opened. But besides the criticism that Rav Dunash, Ibn Labrat, had for Menachem, who criticized his Rebbe, and he had his own criticism of the Rebbe, he was actually, his greatest criticism was really for the Machberes as a whole, for the whole work of Menachem's whole system of understanding the Hebrew language. In a work that begins with a long poem extolling Rav Chisdoy, his patron, and continues on with a longer poem severely criticizing Rav Menachem, he pointed out 200 instances where he felt Rav Menachem had erred. His most bitter criticism was an accusation that Rav Menachem was, chas v'sholom, actually a sympathizer of the Karoyim, the Karaites, who denied the authority of the oral tradition. As a disciple of Rav Sadia, a vehement opponent of the Karaites, Rav Dunash was in all probability extremely sensitive to any hint of such heretical beliefs. History has vindicated Rav Menachem from that accusation, and his disciples strongly defended him in all points. But in that light, in terms of that cloud of suspicion, we can well understand the very puzzling incident relating to Rav Menachem and Rav Chisdoy. Sometime after the publication of his Machberes, Rav Menachem fell into Rav Chisdoy's disgrace. After being accused of some wrongdoing, Rav Chisdoy's agents forcibly evicted Rav Menachem from the community. And evidently, as we're going to see, it was associated with some violence. In our notes, as we're going to quote from some of the letter, it's a beautiful poem that Rav Menachem wrote decrying the violence that was done to him and asking for reconsideration. But before, I just want to go through here on page 2. Again, if we quote, again, Rashi quotes Rav Dunash, again, just as he quoted from Menachem b'Zibn Saruk. He quotes in paragraph C. He quotes from Dunash, as mentioned, the origin of the word Yizach. Again, as a linguist, Dunash felt, again, the Arabic language and the Hebrew language, we find quite often, are linked. And he explained the term based on the Arabic. As we see again, here Menachem composed, this is from Dunash's response. Menachem Chibur Sefer Shemefer Kol Divrei Shefer. Let's say again, the poetry is beautiful. Destroys all the works of beauty. One of the critiques was on the, was actually, it was a bitter critique, is that he felt that Rav Dunash felt that Rav Menachem had translated the word Moloch, which is the way of killing sacrificial birds, he translated in a way similar to the Karoyim, to the carrots, and not according to the tradition. The Malika Dun, the sacrificial birds, is that it's the severing of the a normal animal even when you slaughter birds outside the temple, basically is what you're cutting is the esophagus and the trachea. You come from the front. In Malika, the severing the head, it starts from the back. And basically, the spinal cord is severed first, and then afterwards is the trachea and esophagus severed. He felt, and just that Dunash felt that Rav Menachem had in his translation, who simply used it interchangeably with slaughtering Malika, he had followed really the non-traditional translation of the word, and for that he severely criticized him. And again, says you can just look, says on paragraph E, we quote from other. Again, it says Rashi quotes in Yeshaya, again, an argument between the two. Here's face-to-face. They argue, Dunash takes a much more traditional explanation of a term than Menachem. Here in the poem, I mean, again, here you have the English and the Hebrew, just to give you just a sense. Says Ani Erach, says Mishpot V'Yadati Ki Ani Etzdak. Says Ko Hakota Li, says B'Tshuvas Egarti Asher Shalachta Elai Lemor. Says I state my case. This he's writing back to Rav Chisdoy. And again, we don't have all the details. This letter has been uncovered, was brought from the Cairo Geniza. We don't have the whole story. We can just figure out something from the way it's the presentation. Says, I know I'll be acquitted. And he goes, says, you sent me after the violence was done to him. Says the Rav Chisdoy sent him. If you have sinned, I've already disciplined you as you deserve. And if you've not sinned, I've made you merit eternal life, the world to come. In other words, he dismissed them. Like, if you've sinned, you deserve it. And if you didn't, well, suffering is a good atonement for your sins anyway. So he says, do you consider this a judgment? As he goes on, and he goes in beautiful verse. He says, do you think that such words are proof enough? He says, will not God investigate this? He who's planted the ears, and he goes, will he not hear? He that formed the eye, will he not see? Will you muzzle my mouth with an east wind and silence my tongue with taunting lies? And is not my dust the same as yours, and your God, my God, he who searches out all secrets and delves into man's innermost being? And he comes short of severely, severely criticizing, but very, very close. And it was in this third part of the third poem. I just wanted to capture, it's a long poem. My oppressors have done me violence. I shall cry out to the earth, O earth, cover not my blood. Evidently, he was severely wounded. And it's really, it's a very moving letter. I mean, this whole letter. But the incident, in terms of scholarship, is highly puzzling. Many theories have been advanced. Why did this happen? But perhaps the fact that Rav Dunash, a man held in great esteem by Rav Chisdoy, was a disciple of Rav Sadia, an ardent opponent of the Karoyim, as well as a critic of Rav Menachem's, and Rav Chisdoy himself was a great supporter of the yeshivas in Babylon, as well as the yeshivas in Spain, it doesn't stretch the imagination to say that Rav Chisdoy's relationship with Rav Menachem was poisoned by the accusation of him being a Karaite. For those who remember the McCarthy era, or students of history are familiar with the accusations of heresy hurled at Rivenius and Eibischwitz over 200 years ago, such an atmosphere is not difficult to imagine. The ultimate fate of Rav Menachem is not clear, as all we have is this poem. But the clash of ideas between himself and Rav Dunash created a whole literature that enriched the entire Jewish people. In defense of Rav Menachem, three of his disciples, amongst them Rav Yehuda ibn Chayuj, compiled an entire treatise in defense of Rav Menachem. In response, one of Dunash's disciples, Rav Yehuda ben Sheshes, wrote an entire treatise defending his master. Some 200 years later, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's grandson, wrote a work, Sefer Hachros, to vindicate Rav Menachem. It was followed by Rav Yosef Kimchi, this is the father of Rav Dak, Rav David Kimchi's, Sefer HaGoloi, defending Rav Dunash. So the whole process of argument and counter-argument, the whole field of Hebrew philology, gained clarity and depth. Besides his contribution to our knowledge of the Hebrew language, Rav Dunash created an innovation in Hebrew poetry that set the tone for generations by patterning the rhythm and symmetry of Hebrew poems after the Arabic system. Although Rav Menachem's disciples criticized Rav Dunash's innovation as destroying the holy tongue because it put stress, in order to produce the rhymes, the stress of words changed. It became the prototype of Spanish Hebrew verse, and some of his poems have become very much a part of our lives. Just to give you a sense of how stress can change whole poetry, and one of the great poets, I mean, originally he came from a very observant home and went to the yeshiva of Volozhin. He made turn his life. It was Chaim Nachman Bialik, who at the end of his life, as I understand, came back to his roots. But in that middle period, he wrote, became classic modern Hebrew poetry. There's a major problem for Israelis to use that poetry, because it was written with the standard Ashkenazic stress, not on the last syllable, the milara, but on the next, the penultimate, the next to the last, the mila'el, which is standard for Ashkenazic Jews, perhaps not proper in as we understand Hebrew today, but that was really... An Ashkenazic Jew says Torah. A Sephardic Jew says Torah, right? The stress is in the last. But all his poetry was composed in with the Ashkenazic stress. It's very difficult to reproduce that poetry today. And again, just to give you just a sense of how the stress changes the whole form. The stress was now Arabic, and it was really the cause of tremendous uproar, but it was eventually accepted. Dunash's Doror Yikro is sang throughout the world on Shabbos, and this we quote here, Doror Yikro, Levein Imbas, Vin Sorchem Kamoy Vovas, Nim Shimchem Velo Yishbas, Shavu Venuchu V'yom Shabbos, the Dalet, Vov, Nun, Shin, which goes throughout, next time you sing this, you look it through, it goes throughout the whole program. Also, by Sheva Brachas, as we have by the special grace after meals, which is said by the special banquets we were given for the celebration of a marriage for the Chos and the Kala, it begins with the introduction. Devai Hoser v'gam Charon v'oz Ilein b'shir Yaron necheni b'magli tzedek shei birkas b'nei Yeshurun b'nei Aaron. It spells out Dunash. This is from him. This next time you go to a Sheva Brachas, remember him. So this is Dunash ibn Labrat. Um, The process that began with Rav Sadia Gaon and later with Rav Menachem ben Saruk and Rav Dunash continued on in the next generation with one of the truly original thinkers in the field of Hebrew grammar, Rav Yehuda ben David ibn Hayuj. Born in Fez, Morocco, Ibn Hayuj moved to Cordova, Spain to become a disciple of Menachem ibn Saruk. As you recall, he was one of Menachem's three disciples who defended him against the criticisms of Rav Dunash. Later on, Rav Yehuda went on to make one of the greatest linguistic discoveries of all time. Up until his discovery, it was felt that the Hebrew words had variable roots. Some words had only one letter of the root, some had two, some even had four or five. Rav Yehuda showed that every word in the Hebrew language is made up of a three-letter root stem. Even when a word may appear to contain only one or two letters, Rav Yehuda showed that the word actually did have a three-letter root. However, due to its unique makeup and the process of conjugation, some of the root letters of a word may become deleted. That's why you have kfulim, you have words that there are double letters which tend to fall off. This discovery, which has been highly accepted by most Hebrew grammarians, changed forever our understanding of the basic rules of Hebrew grammar. Ibn Hayyuj composed four works on Hebrew grammar, all in Arabic, the common language of the day. By the way, the works composed, as we said, all those Arabic works, we said, from Rav Sadia and others, which were composed in the Arabic language, were all written in Hebrew letters. That same system of using Hebrew script for a non-Hebraic language was later used for Ladino, the Jewish dialect of Spanish, and to this day for Yiddish, the Jewish dialect of German. So this is the same way. It was Arabic Yiddish. It was written for Jews. Three of Ibn Hayyuj's works, however, were translated into Hebrew, first by Rav Moshe ibn Gikatila, and later by Rav Ram ibn Ezra. We'll speak about both of them in a later lecture. So far tonight, we've mainly spoken of grammarians and linguists. I just want to before we continue on, just again in this on page four, just to just see yourself here on the bottom of page four, in the sense of how he was the esteem this Rav Yehuda's Ibn Hayyuj was held by in subsequent generations. The Ravid, the Sefer Kabbalah, Rav Ram ibn Dawud, who we've quoted extensively, we'll continue to quote him throughout this lecture series. He describes him as the person who put the holy tongue on a clear and firm footing after it had been forgotten throughout the diaspora. I'm probably referring to the idea in terms of the three-letter root. Rav Shlomo ibn Parchon, of the early 12th century, who wrote Machberes HaOruch, which is a Hebrew dictionary, an expanded Hebrew dictionary, refers to Rav Yehuda ibn Hayyuj, was the Hashem, the Creator, revealed to him that which was hidden even from Rav Sadia Gaon. And when upon seeing his book, the scholars of Babylon said, notice the Gaonim were still, they still had the yeshivas then, we have yet to see anything good come from the West with the exception of this book. It's the best in the entire world. Again, up until now, very few people have heard of him, but that's the... But Hebrew grammar really rests very much on his shoulders. The generation after Rav Yehuda Ibn Hayyuj saw a true genius arise from Cordova, who not only was an expert in Hebrew grammar and philology, but also an expert Talmudist, poet, mathematician, linguist, calligraphist, statesman, general, and philanthropist. There's probably since David HaMelech, there's not been a person or Shlomo HaMelech to combine such skills in one individual. His names were Shmuel ben Yosef ibn Nagdela, or Nagrela, who is commonly known as Shmuel HaNogid. Rav Shmuel was born in Cordova, Spain, approximately the year 993. He studied Talmud under Rav Chanoch ben Moshe, which we discussed previously, who had originally come from Italy, who had established Spain as a major center of Talmudic scholarship, and studied grammar under Rav Yehuda ibn Chayuj. So everything now is he's coming together. So again, Rav ibn Chayuj comes from Menachem ben Sorok. These are represents generations here. I'd like to give some background to understand the Spain of Rav Shmuel HaNogid. During the period that we've covered, Spain, except for small sections of the north, was governed by the Arabs. We describe the original Arab conquest of Spain in the year 711. In the year 750, the Abbasid clan in Syria massacred with almost without exception the ruling Umayyad clan that governed all of the Arab world at that time. Again, this is again the subject of previous lecture. And began a new dynasty of caliphs, eventually making Baghdad their capital. Abd al-Rahman, a grandson of the 10th Umayyad caliph, managed to escape the massacre of his Umayyad kinsmen. Pursued by spies of the new regime, Abd Rahman made his way across North Africa to Spain, where eventually united Spain under his rule. Now the story goes that the Abbasids were really after his head. Eventually what he did was he beheaded the Abbasid commander of all of Spain and sent the head back to Baghdad. And the caliph, when he saw the head and the note, I guess, was very happy that he lived all the way out there in Spain and he didn't live next door. He founded a dynasty that eventually, says that his grandson, says Abd al-Rahman III, united all of his great grandfather's empire, the grandfather's empire, and declared himself the caliph. And as up until now, the caliph, the caliph, who considers himself the successor of Muhammad, was only in Baghdad, or was there in the east. He declared himself now. This is at that time, by the way, by the year 929, already the caliphate in Baghdad was crumbling. So he felt pretty comfortable. He declared himself the caliph. He had tremendous power. And under his sponsorship, Cordova became the cultural center of the world. Chizdo ibn Shaprut became his personal physician. Abd al-Rahman III was followed in the year 960 by his son Hakam II, who continued. He had, I believe, instead of Hakam II, he had the largest library in the world. I mean, these are people who treasured scholarship. During their reigns, Cordova became a world-renowned cultural center as well as a leading center of Torah scholarship, because of the Italian captives that settled and created the yeshivas. In the year 976, Hakam's son Hisham II came to power. Being personally weak, which is, again, the problem of dynasties. You know, it's not a meritocracy. It becomes, it's based on family. When the family is good, everything is fine. When it's not, all you have is yichus, You know, it's like they say about yichus, you know, about genial. The yichus is like having a whole bunch of zeros. You know, if you put a one in front of it, it means something. Otherwise, Havel Golnish, you know, it's worthless. He was personally weak. He relied on his military commanders and their foreign mercenary armies to maintain control. And under his reign, the whole empire that was created by his grandfather and his father fell apart. There were the petty kings of the different city-states of Spain. There were 23 in all. Eventually, this became so powerful, they threw off their allegiance to Cordova. In 1012, a civil war erupted in Cordova. The city was eventually taken over by Berbers. The Berbers are the indigenous people of North Africa, of Morocco and Algeria. And they massacred half of the city's inhabitants. You have to realize, I don't want to go too far afield, but they really had, the Arabs who conquered Spain had a real mess on their hands. The Arabic army by itself was composed of two very different parts that were at each other's throats. There were the Yamanis, there were those of South Arabia, and there were the North Arabians. They didn't get along very well. Besides that, they looked themselves as aristocracy. The Berbers, who had been converted to Islam, they looked as a second tier. All it was like a big chont. And as long as the Arabs, you know, the Arab elite, was able to crush any resistance, things were fine. But once they lost their hold, then things started exploding. The Jews were forced to flee. The city that for over half a century became the leading center of Torah study of all of Spain was now devoid of its Jewish population, which is really, if you read Jewish history, you see how much of it just keeps on repeating over and over again. Rav Shmuel HaNogod, we just discussed, who had, at this time had become a considerable scholar, studying under again Rav Chanoch and Rav Yehudi ben Chayuj, fled together with the rest of the Jews and relocated in Malaga, which was under the rule of King Habus. This is the way Rav Avram ibn Daud, the Ravid in the Sefer Kabbalah, describes the events here on page 5. One of the greatest of the disciples of Rav Chanoch was Rav Shmuel HaLevi HaNogod, the prince. He was Yosef ibn Agrila and Agdela from the community of Cordova. He was a Talmudic scholar, was also a great secular scholar. The idea of a combined genius who was not only a Talmudic and biblical scholar, but also a secular scholar, found its first prototype in Rav Sadia Gaon. We find there was also Rav Yitzchak Yisraeli, who was an older contemporary, who was also a physician and a scientist, and it seems a Rosh Yeshiva, but he is, of course, much less famous than Rav Sadia. It generally takes a person of great genius to be good at everything. Shmuel, though, basically followed that tradition. He was an expert in the work of Arab scholars. In other words, he was an Islamic scholar. In fact, one of his works is a critique of the Quran, which did not give him good graces for a lot of people there. He was a spice dealer. You know, who just, you know, you have to make a living, you know. He didn't, you know, Seichel and Mazel don't necessarily always come together. It doesn't always, the one of brilliance has the right Mazel. And he supported himself with difficulty in Cordova, and then he was forced to flee. It says, until the days of destruction of Spain, after the kingdom of the children of Avi Amar came to an end. This is referring to the reign originally of the descendants of Abd al-Rahman. and the Berber princes overthrew the previous order. This happened in the year 1012 till 1013. The city of Cordova became impoverished, and its inhabitants fled. Some fled to Saragossa. Their descendants are there to this day. This was written in the beginning of the first part of the 1100s. This work. So this is speaking about already. This is over 100 years later. The descendants of the original Cordova inhabitants were there. There are those who fled to Toledo. Their descendants are evident there to this day. Shmuel Alevi fled to Malaga. And this is the wine Malaga, if you have for Kiddush, really comes. Again, you'll think about when you make Kiddush. He sat in a store and was once again a spice dealer. His store was right by the courtyard of Ibn al-Arif, the secretary of the king, Habus ben Machshan, the king of the Berbers of Granada. Granada's in southern Spain. If you recall, Granada was the last city that was conquered by the Christians in the beginning of 1492. After they had conquered Granada, they began the consolidation of Christian Spain, which led to the expulsion of the Jews. It was in the hands of the Berbers. The chambermaid of the secretary convinced Rav Shmuel that he composed documents to her master, the vizier. In other words, the vizier is the Sagan, the Mishnah Melech, the vice king. The vizier Abul al-Qasam ibn al-Harif. Now, she needed documents to be sent. He knew he was literate. And she wrote, and he wrote, but of course he wrote in flowery Arabic, in beautiful, masterful prose. The vizier saw the documents, was astounded by his wisdom. After a while, the vizier, Ibn al-Arif, asked permission from his king, Habus, to return to Malaga. Malaga was under the... he was living in Malaga, but it was under the control of Granada. So the vizier went back home, went to Malaga, and there he asked the members of his household, who's writing this? And they said, it's a certain Jew who lives close to your courtyard, who came from the community of Cordova, wrote them for us. The king's secretary immediately commanded them, and they rushed Rav Shmuel Alevi to him. The vizier told him, it's not fitting that you sit in a store, it's a pasnish, no? Don't move from the right or left of me, which is... basically, this is already this. We're dealing with Hebrew colloquialism. So Yomenu Smoil. He did so and became his personal secretary and advisor. He, the vizier, would advise the king according to the advice given him by Rav Shmuel Halevi of blessed memory. Now, so what happened was he was first, besides being a spice dealer, he rose to the letter writer. To the personal advisor. So he became the power behind the vizier, and during this whole period of time, the king didn't know anything of this. Because he's giving this tremendous advice, this vizier, the king holds his vision, overnight he became a zach chacham, you didn't say anything, overnight he became such a chacham, and he didn't tell him really this, his sources. All of his advice was as trustworthy, this is the colloquial Hebrew, as one who would ask of the word of the Urim V'Tumim, of Hashem himself. King Habus became successful through his advice and became exceedingly great. And then afterwards, Ibn al-Harif, the king's secretary, took ill and was dying. And then King Habus felt his... that's the end of his advisor. What's going to happen to him? The king said to him, what will I do? Who will advise me about the wars that surround me? And again, this is a theme that's going to keep on continuing. Granada was constantly at war. Ibn al-Harif answered, I've never advised you on my own. My advice was based on the understanding of my Jewish secretary. Take care of him. He will be your mentor and sage. Implement all that he advises you, and God will be there to assist you. After the death of his secretary, Ibn al-Harif, this is the version that's written in 1020 is written in our works, but it seems it has to be correct at least to the year 1027. The king took Rav Shmuel Alevi to his palace to become a secretary and advisor. Chabus had two sons, Badis, the oldest son, and Balkin. All of the Berber nobility leaned towards appointing Balkin, the younger sons, as Chabus' successor. The rest of the people desired Badis. Even the Jewish segment of the population, including Rav Yosef ben Megash, who was the grandfather of the famous Rav Yosef ben Megash, in the next lecture, Rav Yosef ben Leon, Rav Nehemia, the elite of Granada's Jewry were behind the appointing of Balkin, which was the youngest son. Shmuel Halev was behind the appointment of Badis. So there was much movement, political movement, in terms of, you know, it's all the same, you know. But this is, you know. The day the king Chabus died, the Berber nobility and leadership got up in the morning to make Balkin their king. Immediately, Balkin went over and kissed the hand of his older brother Badis and made him king. This occurred in the year 1027. Again, there's a question about the correct version, the dating of all these events. The faces of his enemies darkened like the bottom of a cauldron. Against their will and personal interest, they were forced to appoint Badis. Subsequently, Balkin regretted having made his brother king and prevailed over his brother Badis. The king Badis was no longer able to do anything, whether it be big or small, without having his brother Balkin as an obstacle in his way. In other words, originally he had rescinded, he had given over the power to his older brother, he had second thoughts, and he really became, he was really now controlling the throne from behind. And Badis really didn't appreciate it that much. But he really, again, all the Berber nobility was behind this Balkin, and he couldn't do much. But sometimes afterwards, his brother Balkin became ill. The king spoke to the doctor to withhold medication from him. The doctor followed the king's order, and Balkin died. The kingdom was now securely in Badis's hand. As a result, the three aforementioned leading members of the Jewish community fled to Seville. Of course, because of all of this, Rav Shmuel Halevi became now the real power behind the throne. And he became the grand vizier, he became the ultimate power. As we've described before, as he described, Granada was involved in constant warfare at that time. Its main nemesis was Seville. Anyone who remembers knows the opera, you know, the famous barber. Rav Shmuel was not only an advisor, he was actually became the commander of the army of Granada. So here we have, it's like David HaMelech. Here we have not only a brilliant Talmudist, a linguist, but he's also a general. He was also, he said, he was an author of tremendous renown. We have printed in the backs of the Talmud, in the first volume, says Brachos, we have what is the Mavoh HaTalmud, which seems to be a fragment of a much larger work. This is an introduction to the Talmud. He also wrote the Hilchos HaGevurta, which is a halacha compendium, which was lost. As he says that he wrote, as much of what he wrote. Was written in Arabic, as we quote here on page 7, paragraph D. But this work of the Hilchos HaGevurta is quoted by many of the greats of the 12th century and the 13th century, the Baal HaMor, the Ramban, Eshkol, and this is of the late of the late 11th century Rav Yitzchak Gias. He was a person who was respected, was given the greatest respect. He was also, besides being halachas, he was a very gifted poet. He continues on the story on page 8 about how his life, as Rav Shmuel HaNogid, Rav Shmuel HaLevi was appointed Nogid in the year 1027. It's a question of the years, perhaps it's 1037. He did many great favors for the Jews of Spain, Morocco, Africa, which is Algeria and Tunisia, Egypt, and Sicily. His influence reached all the way to the yeshiva of Bovel of Iraq and to the holy city Yerushalayim. All of the students of Torah in these lands benefit by his philanthropy. He acquired many works of the holy writs, as of scriptures, as Mishnah and Talmud. He would provide support to anyone who wanted to solely dedicate himself to the study of Torah, whether in the land of Spain or any of the aforementioned lands. He hired scribes to write copies of the Mishnah and Talmud in order to give them away free of charge to students in the yeshivas of Spain or any of the aforementioned lands who did not have the ability to acquire them on their own. In addition, he provided olive oil to the synagogues of Yerushalayim every year. He spread much Torah throughout the world, and he died at a fine old age after he'd merited to four crowns, a crown of Torah, a crown of wealth and power, the crown of Levi, he was a Levi, and above all, the crown that towered above all the rest, the crown of a good name through good deeds. He died in the year, according to the Ravid, there's a question of the dating, in the year 1055. So he was a tremendous Baal Tzedakah, tremendous person of philanthropy. There's a story told, because of his high position, there was much jealousy, was much intrigue in the royal court. Well, he's the only Jew of the highest office amongst Arabs, and it's understandable, Berbers, and it's understandably that there was much resentment. There was one particular accusation that was hurled against him, that he was pilfering, that he was actually taking, you know, from the royal treasury and enriching himself at the expense of the king. So the king called him in and wanted him to give a personal tally of his wealth, which he came back and gave a personality of his wealth. And the king looked at the bottom figure, and he was shocked. And he says, "This is wrong." He says, "I know you live, your home, you live, it's much more than what you're telling me in here. You've written down to me the list of all your wealth." So Rav Shmuel Nogid explained to the king, "No, you don't understand. This is a list of my tzedakas. This is a list of my philanthropy. That's my wealth. That will last for all times. The other wealth just comes and goes. This is my wealth." You know, there's another story that's told of him, that he was walking the streets, again, because of this, all of this, the jealousy. There was one Muslim fanatic who felt that, which is this is a recurring theme in history, according to the doctrine which was first promulgated in the Quran by Muhammad, the Jews are only in Arab lands, are only to be given the status of dhimis, secondary citizens, barely tolerated. And now we have a Jew who basically runs the country, which is very difficult for them. And there was one particular Arab that started, as he's walking, started hurling epithets, in other words, curses, you know, at Shmuel HaNogid as he's going in the street. And the king was taken aback. Maybe the person didn't recognize the king. So he told Shmuel HaNogid, says, "Have that man's tongue cut out." Sometime later, they're walking through the streets again, and that same man comes out and starts heaping praises on Rav Shmuel HaNogid. He's so wonderful in what he does. And so the king looked at him and said, "That same guy." He says, says, I told you to cut out his tongue. He says, I did. I gave him a few presents. And that tongue changed from hurling epithets to praises. He's a brilliant person. Moshe Ibn Ezra, which we're going to discuss in a future lecture, one of the great poets of Spain, whose origin came from Granada, describes Shmuel HaNogad as a poet in the following terms. Their prince and patron was the Nogad of Shmuel HaLevi. He was a Meridan from Merida, which was again a town in southern Spain. By virtue of his family origins, he was a Cordovan by virtue of his birth, and he was a Granadan by virtue of position of Nogad, of prince. His poems were amazingly crafted. They were a creation of a lofty poetic spirit that inspired them with a beauty and clarity of expression, metaphors that were full of power and force, beautifully arranged with impressive themes. His works of poems were Ben Tehillim, Ben Mishlei, Ben Kohelis, bear witness to all of this. His work Ben Tehillim, this is the son of Tehillim of Psalms, contains within prayers and pleas that arrange according to the science of music and poetic meter and rhythm. No one before or after him has taken such an approach. In all of these works, he has worked with much toil and diligence, for he has incorporated a great many of the parables of the Arabs and of other nations, the sayings of the philosophers, the flowery expressions of the ancient peoples, as well as the precious aphorisms of our sages. Again, he was a world scholar, Shmuel HaNogad, and really brought the wisdom of the world into his poems. He wrote all of this in a very clear language with expression that penetrated straight into the heart. I'd just like to read to you, just to give you just a sense, just a little sense of some of his poetry. Again, it says, we have on page 9 in paragraph D. This is Bitos etzbecho chazek levovcho. In a time of sorrow, take heart. Vim tamod says, alai shara harega. Even if you're standing at death's door, remember the following. Lener to a candle, maor beterem hidicho, flares up before it dies. It's just because the enemy seems to have all this power, it may be just the last moments before the end. V'lekfirim medukarim shogo. The wounded lions roar before they die. In other words, don't be impressed by their power. This may be just their last gasp. Here on he wrote, which is again, which parallels Arabic themes. He wrote wine songs, which is again very strange, but it was the work of a genius. And again, just as it's beautiful. The rhymes are beautiful. The idea just it captures. Again, it's atypical generally of the normative Talmudic scholar. But Shmuel was basically in a class. Really, there's none the like for thousands of years. Ma'odim b'marehu v'orev l'shosehu, like it's red to the eye, sweet to the drinker. Mozog b'spamio v'zichro says Elihodu. It's poured out in Spain, but its bouquet it's remembered all the way to India. In other words, it just, and it's poetically saying, the smell wafts through the air all the way to India. V'chalosh b'agonov avobal, says in the bowl, says it's feeble. Says avobalosel roshim, but when it comes to the head, as a yirdu b'roshim asher yirdu, but it holds sway over, says, either swaying heads or rulers of state. Now, there's wine, maybe feeble ones, and when it comes inside, it controls. I mean, it's just beautiful. The again, hodu yerdu. If you see the shakul asher domov Musuchim Bidemosov, the Shakul is the wretched person whose blood, heart's blood is mixed with his tears. In other words, he's Nebuch, he's Fatsorovitz, he's Yegoinov Bedam Eshkol Yenusum Vyadodu. His tears banish, with his tears, with the blood of the Dam Eshkol, with the blood of the grape, of the cluster of grapes, his sorrows are banished. It says, Ki'ilu Yedidim, says, Eis Yisubum Ashishaisov, Miyod Liyod, Goral Alei Yahalom Yadu. As the goblets make the rounds, passing from hand to hand, speaking about a feast, it seems as if the friends are casting lots for a diamond. In other words, give me the drink. And again, just in describing the, he was in his power not only of poetry, but of really of capturing the emotions of the scene. And then finally, just he was a creator of, again, unprecedented, of poetry of war. He describes the battles in poetic, and you have the sense of the battle. Again, this is only just part of a much larger poem, but again, to give you just a sense. V'kom Hatzor, says the enemy, says, rose. You have to realize the enemy is from Seville. V'kom Hatzor l'negdav. But the rock means Hashem rose against him. Hashem is on our side. This is how he's how could any creature rise up against his creator? Now my troops and the enemies drop up their ranks opposite each other. Anoshim Yachshavu Yom Afachemo. On such a day of anger, jealousy, and rage, men deem the prince of death a princely prize. As they're really to die for the glory of Kolechod Yavakesh Lo Kano Shame Venafsho Basha Yikno Mechuro. And everyone, and each man seeks to win renown, though he must lose his life for it. So now he describes basically the scene. V'noa domo misodo v'nefcho k'mapecho samoro. The earth's foundations overthrown like Gomorrah, Amorah, reel to and fro, and as you get the sense of the warring armies and how the earth is shaking. V'fonim kibtzu faruv v'hodor. And it was every face turned red or black as the bottom of a pot. Nefchu elei shuli kedeiro, v'hayom yom arofel v'chashecho. The day is dark, v'ashemesh k'molus is libi shechora. And the sun was as black as my heart. In other words, he himself was feeling the tension. As I said, the Ben Tehillim was a sequel to Psalms. He had a collection of maxims, you know, wisdom literature called Ben Mishlei. And he had a poetical philosophical work, which he called Ben Koheles. This is all in rhyme. Another of Cordova's great scholars was a contemporary of Rav Shmuel HaNogid, Rav Yonah ibn Janach. The word Janach, which means winged one, is a loose translation of Yonah, a dove. It's not clear if Rav Yonah studied under Rav Yehuda ibn Hayyug, but he clearly studied on grammar under Ibn Hayyug's contemporaries, Rav Yitzhak ben Marshall, Rav Yitzhak Gikatila, a disciple of Menachem ibn Saruk. So this contemporary of Rav Shmuel's, Rav Yonah ben Janach, held Ibn Hayyug in the greatest regard, and acknowledged that much of his own knowledge of grammar was due to Ibn Hayyug's teachings. And he viewed his own works as a mere extension of the master. However, in his first published work, the Sefer Hasagah, Ben Janach points out numerous roots that, in his opinions, Ibn Chayyug was either unaware or mistaken, which is part of the whole scholarly process. It seems the disciples of Ibn Chayyug had taken exception to his criticism of their master. Rav Shmuel HaNogid, himself a disciple of Ibn Chayyug, began to prepare a work in Ibn Chayyug's defense. As we know, but he wrote a work on grammar. Before it was published, Rav Yonah Ibn Janach took the initiative and penned a strong response in a work called Sefer HaShvaah. Rav Shmuel HaNogid evidently was not satisfied with Ibn Janach and wrote a work, Igros HaChaverim, defending his master and attacking Ibn Janach's approach. This brought additional responses and pamphlets from both sides. This exchange, of course, brought additional insight to the study of Hebrew linguistics. In a sense, this reminds us early on we studied the story of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, the great Talmudic sages, that when Reish Lakish died, Rabbi Yochanan cried, says that he really became so ill he lost his mind. Because when Reish Lakish, when Rav Yochanan would give a shiur, a lecture, Reish Lakish would ask 24 questions. And of course he would have to defend himself, and he would of course retort. And through the whole process, a whole new understanding of the Talmud arose. In this sense, basically, this process we see. In addition, Ibn Janach wrote two works, the Sefer HaDikduk, with the rules of grammar, and Sefer HaRikma, with the roots of all words found in the Bible. Unfortunately, all of his works were written in Arabic, effectively blocking their use from non-Arabic-speaking Jews. Only in recent times have Hebrew translations of some of his works become available, and we really, up until now, we only knew of them through works of, you know, of later, you know, of contemporaries, of later grammarians. But I just want, again, this is a name you've probably never heard of, but in terms of the history of Hebrew grammar, we see with the great respect that he was given, says, by those who followed him. On page 10, again, just you could read through on yourself, of what what he was, you know, in terms of how he was thought by the reviews. Yedaya Panini, who was a great philosopher of the scholar of province, the Ravid, which we quoted before, Ibn Ezra, his work is wholly filled with treasures. And this is a work, the last one was written by an Arab who describes Jewish scholars. It was a work really discussing scholars of all nations. And it says, and with him was in Saragossa Marwan, which is Arabic name, for Yonah Ibn Janach, of the people of interest in the art of logic and wide knowledge in the science of the language of the Arabs and Jews. Evidently, he was not only a scholar of grammar, but he was he knew philosophy as well as Arabic language. He has an excellent treatise on the preparation of simple medicaments, the medicines, and the limitations of the quantities of weights and measures to be employed in the medical art. He was a practicing physician. Again, which we will find again time and time again in Spain, the notion of people who were not only great scholars, Hebrew scholars, but were great general scholars. But then again, generally you need for... These people were really true geniuses. And it's very hard to be good at everything. Rav Shmuel HaLevi Nogid was succeeded by his son, another genius, another great scholar, of Yehosef HaLevi HaNogid, which he described by the Ravid here on page 11. He had all the fine traits of his father with the exception of humility, which was really, it's hard to know, but evidently he felt, and evidently it's hard to know in terms of humility how a person is on the inside and how he felt in terms of being the grand vizier, in terms of the leader of the community, how he had to conduct himself in dealing with other people. So it's really hard to know in terms of if he was what he was as the man, really, but he projected at least the sense of pomp. Because he grew up with wealth and was not burdened and humbled in his youth, this is how the Rivet explains his father had been, he was extremely arrogant in his mannerisms. The Berber nobility was extremely jealous of him, and they arose and killed him. On Shabbos, the 9th of Tevis in 1067, together with the Jewish community of Granada and all those who had come from distant lands to see his Torah knowledge and wealth. He was a tremendous scholar. People would come to him, a tremendous library, and he was a patron. And he, like his father, supported Torah scholarship throughout the world. Mourning over his death was conducted in every country and city. And this we've touched upon in a previous lecture. He died on the 9th of Teves, which we know from earlier sources was a day of fasting, but no reason was given. The Rivet claims that they knew with Ruach HaKodesh, you know, that this was a day which was destined for tragedy. Just to end, just interesting again, we're going to connect this with the next lecture. Rishmul HaNogad was very close. You could read this on your own, this last section. Rishmul HaNogad was very close to the scholars of his time, Rav Nissen Gaon, Rav Hananel. These were the scholars of North Africa, and through them to Rav Hai Gaon, the great, the last and most the greatest of the Rosh Yeshivas in Bavel. The connection with Rav Nissen was to such an extent that Rav Yosef, his son, married the daughter of Rav Nissen Gaon. He describes, interesting, the Rivet, that it was an arranged marriage, but she did not. There were problems with the marriage. I mean, she was imbued with Torah learning, a fear of heaven. And when her husband, Rabbi Yosef, died, she fled to the city of Lucina. The community of Lucina supported her with dignity until the day of her death. And this really ends, you know, the chapter of the family of Shmuel HaNogad. With the death of Rav Yehosef, this is a special chapter, this is in our history, came to an end. Because here we find, beginning with Chizdoy ibn Shaprut, continuing on with Shmuel and with his son, Jews who not only had tremendous power, but combined that with tremendous philanthropy and support for all Torah endeavors. It seems that uniquely came to an end. No one of their like, perhaps the Abarbanel, we find in terms of at the end of the period of Spain, a person at least with such power. But we never find someone combining all these traits plus the supporter and the patron of Torah throughout the world. Next lecture, we will deal with the history of North African Jewry at this time, and culminating with the Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, who from North Africa basically founded a yeshiva and a whole new chapter of scholarship in Spain. Are there any questions? Okay, in terms of the first question, we find the idea in the acronym. In other words, we find of a people's name, we find as early as the Kalir, and earlier, Elazar Kalir writes his name, looks through the Kinos and does Eliezer, says HaKalir, Ben Kalir, Be'Rebbe Kalir. It seems we quoted in the lecture we have on the Piyutim, it seems that some of the commentaries deal with the idea of at least of acrostics and perhaps names. It was a poem's. It was the signature of the poem. It was like the if you were a person who writes a sefer, generally puts his name to the sefer. This was his way of presenting who the author is. I mean, I don't know if there's anything wrong with this. In a certain sense, there's a just like in a sefer, you'd like to know who the author is before you open it up. It gives you a sense of, you know, your time is limited. You can't look at every sefer. But it was common custom, and in terms of scholars, it's very when I read a from Slichas, you really want to know who the author is, and unless there's a name, there's no way of knowing who composed it, and they give a sense of when it was composed and what conditions it was composed. It's really extremely helpful to know, you know, and it gives you the sense. And in a certain sense, we have the Gemara says, you know, that Rabbi Yochanan, there's a Gemara at the end of Yevamos and Sadek Hei Amud Beis and Sadek Vov Amud Aleph. Rabbi Yochanan was very mocked, but was very concerned that when his Talmidim, the disciples, say something over that they heard from him, they say it over in his name. The of Doivos Bekever says that even after a person's dead, says his lips still move in the grave. And one says that people should his presence should still be on earth. You know, so it's a form of immortality. This is a theme that we're going to go back to throughout this lecture, about the question was, how do we compare the Spanish period with this all-inclusive secularism with the period of, let's say, in Eastern Europe, which was much more isolationist. I can't, because of the time, and because of the, and this is a theme that we're going to go throughout this whole lecture series, but I'd like to leave you with an idea. It's just very important to realize. For those of who lived in this period, they did not view secular studies per se, at least in this period. We're going to deal with a different period that viewed secular studies with great in Spain and in France, that viewed secular studies with great suspicion. But in this period, they viewed this as part of inclusive knowledge, which they felt was an enhancement for them. I mean, again, I stress, it's again, a person who is not of the stature of a genius, and wants to be a Talmudic scholar and a mathematician and an astronomer and a calligraphist and a poet, and he would probably advise to become a Talmudist. But they had no qualms of people as expanding during that time. On the other hand, since there was no, at least because of really, which goes back to the position of the church and secular knowledge and of Jews in Eastern Europe as a whole, that we're not connected, we're not part of the non-Jewish societies. All of this, their understanding of all the secular sciences came from their being able to speak Arabic and to read Arabic, and because of the high tolerance that existed in that society, Jews by and large in Lithuania were really were blocked out from that form of knowledge, and it never became part and parcel of historically of the Jewish community. So if one wanted to study that, one would have to really go out of the Jewish community, and then it became a question of compromise then. Not that it basically, that it was a fulfillment, you know, or expansion of your Jewish knowledge, but really it was either this or that. And there was a tremendous fear because that knowledge was so associated with non-Jewish society, that you would, by process of going over there to get it because it wasn't available here, you would be influenced by non-Jewish society. Which there's a beautiful story. The Jews were adamant in Eastern Europe and Russia in the late 1800s from studying even the Russian language. The reason was because the Russian Orthodox Church wanted to convert the Jewish population, and they felt that if the Jews knew the Russian language, it would be an entree to know Russian culture and Russian religion. The Jews were very strongly opposed. One of the maskilim, one of the more liberal Jews, asked Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was the chief rabbi of Kovno, Lithuania, a man who was very much respected by maskilim, liberal Jews, why their position is so antagonistic to secular or to Russian language, not even secular studies. And he answered as follows. Some years before, in the city of Brod, which is in the border between the Austrian Hungarian Empire, the Austrian Empire, and the Russian Empire by Galicia, the city of Brod, which was a famous city of scholars, there was a famine Passover time. The Ashkenazic custom is not to eat legumes on Passover, not to eat beans. But they, because of the famine, the rabbinate, the Besdin, allowed eating legumes. In Broad, in the city of Broad, they never ate beans by themselves. There was a food called Broder Lokshen. In other words, in Broad, they had noodles, Lokshen, together with beans. So when the rabbis told them that they can have beans, and they prepared beans, it came the Seder night, they came and they found steaming bowls of not only beans, but Lokshen,
which is not Pesach day.
And they said, what happened? I mean, you've never served chometz, you never served non-Pesach food. She says, listen, the rabbis told us that we could have beans. Nobody in Broad eats beans without Lokshen. So it's tantamount. When you say beans, you mean beans and Lokshen. There's a whole problem. They have to kosher out all their kalim, all that. It was a mess. So Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan continued on. He says, if I would be sure that all they would have is beans, in other words, they would have just the Russian language, okay, Jews have always studied, have known the language. But it's not a question of just of the Russian language. It comes with the chometz. It comes with the lokshen. And it says that's something we can't tolerate. So it really is partially, it's a cultural thing. When does it represent a problem, and when... Then it represented a problem. It doesn't necessarily always represent a problem, but it's like timing is everything, you know.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.